seconds ago. You've watched us meet. But I could probably sense that some of the statements, from, especially the second half of Christopher Rhodes' talk, probably hit quite home to you, because I know over the years you have been interested in oral history and in preserving the cultural heritage of your people and of the regions of the country where you are. And about documentation, Carlos is the head of the map library at UCLA, and there is a documentation of the world in a visual sense. And there are several things which I have enjoyed about this convention, as well as several other conventions in recent years. It gives me a chance to finally get to meet some of the people who were instrumental in the beginning and founding of ARS. There are a couple of names which come to mind when I think back to some of the first issues of the Ars Journal, and Milo Ryan and Carlos Hagen are the two names which come to mind, because both of them were quite disturbed in the poor treatment which sound archives were being given back in the early days, back in the 1960s. And Christopher Rhodes just spoke of one of the problems which they are still having over in England, which Joe Pengelly has been talking to about for years, that he's trying to find an institution that will give a degree based on oral history and oral information, that it shouldn't just have to be printed. And so when I knew we were coming out to California, I desperately wanted to have Carlos give us a talk, because I wanted, if nothing else, to get a chance to meet you after all of these years. And that was my ulterior motive in planning this. So without further ado, here's Carlos Hagen.
Well, it's very good to be among so many good friends. I was, as you say, one of the founding members of this ARSC between 1965 and 70. For two terms, I was the second vice president. And I'm a geographer, and I'm the director of the Map Library at UCLA. And I was born in Chile, and I'm going to talk about sound documentaries, radio access, and one of the questions that is most asked of me is, say, why do you do the things you do, you know, the sound documentaries, this radio program that I've been doing for the last 20 years. And I thought that I would briefly describe you the background. I'm writing a sort of an article for the Music Library Association on the reasons, so I will not go too deep into that. But growing up and going to school in Chile in the year that followed the Second World War was very exciting, very rewarding. I'm very grateful that I had that chance. Latin America, for about 100 years, from the mid-1800s to the 1950s or so, was under a sort of attitude of life that we call generally positivism, lack of a better name. It's based on the philosophies of Comte, with a lot of also input from the philosophies of people like Nietzsche, Ortega y Gasset, and two great thinkers from Britain, from the Victorian England, Herbert Spencer and John Stuart Mill. And this is a great emphasis on freedom of information, freedom of inquiry and expression, especially the ideas of John Stuart Mill. And also tremendous emphasis on education. You try to create an educated class. As a matter of fact, the liceo in Latin America, Argentina, Brazil, Chile, and so on, was very much patterned after the gymnasium of Germany or the public schools of Great Britain. In the liceo, I attended people who were going to the university. We have about 16 academic subjects, classics, Latin and Greek, plus three foreign languages. But you see, this whole milieu of Latin America presupposes that the educated person has a duty to his or her society, a sacred obligation to bring that education, that enlightenment, that knowledge back to the society in which you are. In this case, whether it would be Chile or it would be here the US. So I came here with that strong feeling. In Chile, we were an underdeveloped country, but the musical life was extremely rich. We had an organization under the University of Chile that recorded every single concert that took place in the major cities, and immediately, a week after, they are available free of charge to any radio station that want to broadcast them. Radio stations were open to record collectors who wanted to go there and discuss their collections. As a matter of fact, when I was in college, I was doing a radio program on American composers. I was very much interested, not only in the classical composers like Copland, Henry Cowell, and so on, but also Broadway composers, popular composers. So with that, you see, upbringing, with that educational background, I came to this country to continue my education in geography and cartography. And when I came here, I was totally appalled at the lack of knowledge, lack of exposure of people to the richness of cultural life, especially our Western civilization. And I found in monolingual culture, you have heard many times these accounts of college students who cannot locate on a map Vietnam, Cuba, France, Great Britain. They don't know. They had never heard about the great classics. They had never been exposed to the music of Brahms or Mozart, even less of more obscure composers. So that is why I decided I'm going to do something, because that's what my society, my culture taught me. So that's why I have been doing a lot of writing. I have written over 100 articles, a book, and I have produced about 700 radio programs. I don't like too much to call them radio programs. They're rather documentaries, sound, audio documentaries. They're essays in sound. That's also the reason why I was attracted so much to the old Pacifica before it became very politicized. There in that Pacifica of the 1960s, I found a place very much like the Chilean radios, where a collector, an artist, an intellectual, a thinker could go and just talk, share his or her knowledge and record collection with the audience. And that's why I began my, you might say, career in radio in Pacifica. I remember that time talking to a good friend of mine at Pacifica about radio, and he said, radio is like a monster that swallows up all of your productions and nothing is left behind. And I decided never that would be the case with me. That's why everything I do is on tape. And I put every program on tape. That's why I don't like too much to call them radio programs. They are rather essays on sound, because they could be used for academic institutions, later on. And that's why I put so much emphasis on scholarship, accuracy, authenticity. My program has, in radio parlance, is called a ratio generally of 1:1. That is, for 1 minute of air, you put about 1 hour or more of research. Presently, I produce radio programs for a station in Santa Monica, KCRW, you have here the program guide. And they are half an hour, and I produce them once a week. And each program cost me about anywhere between 20 and 40 hours of total time, research and production. So that will give you an idea of the work that goes into that. I have a cassette here. I'm going to put you some excerpts in a few minutes. So many people also ask me, can we listen to your programs in other places? And the answer, unfortunately, is not too many other places. The New Pacific, as well as many other community stations, have become very political. I understand, you know, I can see their point of view. For people who are very committed to issues of the time, like apartheid, consumerism, women's and gay liberation, nuclear disarmament, these programs I produce, these essays, they sound too elitist, too bourgeois, and those are the words I have been told about this program from some of these people. What about National Public Radio? Well, there was an attempt in 1980 to create a sort of a branch of National Public Radio that would be like the third program of the BBC, very much along the line of the old Pacifica, but it did not go. National Public Radio was having its funds cut back, there was mismanagement, and they were not acquiring the large audience that they wanted, so that whole thing was scrapped. So National Public Radio is very much into news, drama, and the big bug in radio now, in public educational radio, is the docudrama and high-tech, where everything had to be stereo, high-tech, and docudrama, and maybe, you know, 3 or 5 minute documentaries. And I have not wanted to go into that at all. It would be too limiting, I feel. And many times I have been told also, if you could produce a program maybe with a professional announcer without a foreign accent, maybe we could consider, but that would be too difficult. I have a full-time job, I would have to pay announcers, I could not do that. And I have two very important matters of principle here. One is, we are coming into a multicultural society, the US, and in a way, in a very small way, I want to give the example to newcomers, the new waves of immigrants from Vietnam, Central America, Russia, Korea, that they can too go into media without having to have the polished, high glossy, professional announcer's voice, the all American, you see, non-descriptive sound. And the other reason is because I also want to give the example that you can still, in this country, produce one-man productions, that you don't need a staff of sound engineers, producer, assistant producer, assistant to the technical director, and so on. And there are many programs when you hear, you know, these programs that are being broadcast by National Public Radio, at the end, you have about 1 minute of announcing of the credits. So, but I have the same faith in this production that probably Charles Ives had in his music. They are not being broadcast except maybe by a few stations, but I know that they are high quality, high scholarship, and that they include very unique recordings. And it's kind of sad for me when I get letters, whenever some of my programs ends up by chance in, let's say, in the little town of Illinois, or in Seattle, or in Boston, I get letters, very beautiful letters, saying, where could we get a chance to listen more of this production? And the answer, of course, is, I'm sorry, I cannot do it. I don't have the time to be a distribution agency. Somebody else will have to do it. So there I have about 700 programs that are very little broadcast, but that's the way we are in the, at the present time in the US. What are the type of programs that I have produced of those 600-700 I have? I will just give you a very brief description. For the Olympic Games in Los Angeles, I produced 4 documentaries on music and the Olympic Games. My resources were so vast that I could have spent hours, but they were just 4 very concise half an hour programs, covering from the first Olympiad all the way to the Berlin Games and the Tokyo and Melbourne, all of the various Olympiads. So far that I know, I'm the only one that produced that kind of things in Los Angeles with that wide perspective. Then another thing I'm very excited is the music of the old American West. If you were a traveler in that period that the American West generates all of these fantasies, it basically, you see, it was between the end of the Civil War, late 1860s to the 1910s. If you were a traveler going through the old American West, what was the music that you would hear? Of course, cowboy songs, that comes to mind right away, but there was much, much, much more. The military music in the forts, the music in the saloons, the music in the houses, in the residences, in the theaters, in San Francisco, in Seattle, in Oklahoma, and so on. Then another series of programs is that I'm preparing is on the popular or art songs of the Hispanic American world, especially in the 1910s and 20s, that achieved tremendous popularity all over the world. Everybody has heard La Paloma or La Golondrina or La Violetera or some other. I'm dedicating one single program to the history and the background of that particular song. Then I'm especially interested in the 1930s and 20s, two crucial decades in Western civilization that, for many reasons, I don't want to go into that now, are tremendously important as a sort of divisory line in Western civilization, those 2 decades between 2 world wars, the mystique, the popular songs, the everything. And then I'm producing another series on standards of appreciation and judgment of the new American music. Take the case of Steve Reich, Terry Riley, Phil Glass, Lamonte Young. Many people consider that junk, and there have been many destructive criticisms. So I'm trying to explain, how do we appreciate, what are these people trying to convey to their audiences, and how can we appreciate what they are doing? So that's a very brief description of some of the things I'm doing, and I have to say I'm very grateful to the National Endowment for the Arts. They have supported through some grants, some of the programs have produced, and as well as many other things that do not have that much popular appeal. They have supported also poets, writers, filmmakers, and I think that speaks very highly for them. So I want to play now a very short segment. This will tell you the search for authenticity. I will begin with just in about 3 minutes that cassettes. Music of the Old American West. From the Library of Congress, I have obtained a number of very unique recordings. The first one you will hear is John Lomax, an old-timer that he recorded in the 1940s, singing one of the typical cowboy songs. Then from the National Archives, that have been extremely helpful too, especially Les Waffen, who is not here unfortunately, but they have provided me with a lot of very interesting material. I have a bugle of the American Cavalry, recorded in 1896. And then also the search for authenticity comes into the present. Contemporary recordings, of course. Let's take the case of the military music that was very predominant in the old American West. Now, I don't want to include in my program those wonderful recordings of the US Marine Band or the Eastman Wind Ensemble with all of the virtuosity and proficiency. That's not the way that music sounded in the old American West. You don't want either to hear, you know, a amateur high school band. Those people in those outposts, in those forts, were professional musicians, but they had very limited instruments, old-fashioned instruments, that they had very small ensembles. So again, through the National Archives, I got in contact with a very obscure, small outfit that's called the Company of Military Historians, and they produced precisely a record of the authentic music as it sounded, as it was played with those instruments in the old American West, in the old forts. And finally, in this segment I have Tony Thomas, is a fiddler who have specialized to recreate the sound that was heard in the saloons of the old American West. In this case of the band, I'm going to tell you, I don't know if you have seen a magnificent movie by the Australian director Bruce Hereford, Breaker Morant, that concerned the Boer War at the early years of the century in South Africa. And they have a magnificent scene there where they recreate the bandstand on a Sunday in a small South African town. They're playing some of those British bands. Wonderful, authentic sound. It was done by a very small provincial band, I understand. But when the record came out for commercial purposes, those cuts were replaced by a magnificent recording, professional, lush sound by the New South Wales, I think, police band. It's the same thing, you know, that putting this march I'm going to play you now, played by the Eastman Wind Ensemble or by the US Marine Band. So anyway, listen now to these 4 things, the old cowboy song, the bugler, the march from the 7th Regiment of Cavalry of the famous U.S. Cavalry of the old American West, that was the Irish tune Gary Owen, and then Jack of Diamonds, a tune of the old saloons.
Go closer to me, comrade, and listen to what I say. I'm going to tell a story while my spirit hastens away. Way back in Northwest Texas, that good old Lone Star State. Thank you.
from that series I produced on the Hispanic American songs, La Paloma, I found out that this song was embraced with passion by the Germans. I don't know what the reason, but it had been one of the most popular songs in Germany ever since the 19th century. And here I have a Spanish baritone, Juan Luria, recorded in the early 1900s, singing that song in German. And then from a collector in Germany, a group of German sailors humming that song, a contemporary. Of programs I'm doing on the 1920s and 30s, especially in Europe, there was a big mystique about the Apache, in French, the Apache. It was basically the pimp, the gigolo and their girlfriends in the Paris of the 1920s, and it spread all over Europe. Even Franz Lehár wrote the famous operetta La Gigolette. And I found a remarkable man, Georges Clayet. He's a French attorney, 82 years old, who was in Paris, who was who frequented the Salon of Gertrude Stein. He was a friend of Hemingway, James Joyce, Henri Matisse, and I have many hours of conversation with him in his about his experiences that I have incorporated in a number of programs, and we talked for about 1 hour just on the subject of the mystique of the Apache, that in the Europe of those times it was a mystique as big probably as here in the 70s as the truck driver. So I have here a short conversation excerpt where we talk about the Apache, followed by something that I got from a French collector, a Java, the dance of the Apache, performed in the 1950s by an ensemble that specialized in recreating the authentic sounds of the 20s.
Draw closer to me, comrade, and listen to what...
I think we went
to the beginning. Rewind.
Yeah.
There was a place which was famous, even today, it's history, but they speak about it, and it was Le Bal de la Rue de Lappe. With the Rue de Lappe as a street near the Bastille section, it's still the 11th arrondissement, I think. Very close, anyway, to the Bastille, where there was a very famous ball, and the public, who was adventurous, wanted to an excitement, could meet the Apache there, and there she collects. And in fact, it started that the fashion started that way for everybody. But they had some trousers. Their pockets were not like this one I'm showing you now. You know, the regular one, but they were on top, near the belt. And so they gave them a very bold attitude when they dance.
You put your hands right in front of your belly,
like that. Right. And this attitude I'm showing, of course you can't see that, you can't hear that, but you can see it, you know, the attitude was like this, you know.
A defiant attitude.
Yeah, a defiant attitude, a boldness, a challenge.
Very virile, very muscular.
Oh, very, very, yes. In fact, it's a style of the Java. It should be danced that way. Even today, there's a Java. It's danced that way, more or less. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And women had their hands on their back.
When you do these kind of programs, when you're looking for such authenticity, scholarship, you have to have access, of course, to sound archives. And I found it extremely difficult when I began. So I have been collecting records for about 22 years, ever since I came to Los Angeles. And Los Angeles is a wonderful place to collect because it's an international center of record production. And also when you have the contact I have with radio stations, with universities, with the archives, with the secondhand record shops. And I am very indebted, by the way, to a number of record dealers, people who work in record shops. They know what I'm doing. They have been very cooperative. And many times they set aside for me certain records. So I have, without too much work, I would say, I have collected so far a very remarkable collection. Some of you, I think four or five, have been to my place. And I went very much in depth to build a bunker, a concrete building to store all of the material. It's a sort of a one-man BBC archive and library, because it also has many ephemera, catalogs, reference materials. The extent is about, right now, about 50,000 LPs, about 12,078, and about 8,000 reels of tape. And to give you an idea, it's about one half the size of Bowling Green State University archives. In the newsletter of the arts, in the last one, they announced there that Bowling Green got a 100,000 grant from the NEA, National Endowment for the Humanities, to begin the catalog. That will give you an idea. So I don't have the collection catalog. It would be totally impossible. It's only classified, and I can hardly use it mainly for the production of these audio documentaries. And I hope that one day this collection will be the center of will be a center for the production of audio documentaries with those concepts of the most total freedom of inquiry, access, and expression. And as a matter of fact, I wrote an article for the YESA bulletin a few issues back. This is the International Association of Sound Archives, about intellectual freedom and some barriers to accessibility to sound recordings. And that's the topic in the next 5 minutes we'll try to think of this talk. Access. At the beginning, I would say in the 60s, it was an absolute nightmare to copy, to get, and that's why, in a way, why I was prompted to start my own collection. Nowadays, you go to a library, and if you want, under the fair use provision of the copyright law, you need an article or a few pages, you just go to the copying machine, put 5 cents, and that's it. I remember many times I tried to get from some sound archives some recordings I needed for these documentaries, and came back saying, you have to get the written permission from the publisher and the artist and the conductor and the record company. Then I would send back and say, look, one moment, I'm sorry. I'm not trying to produce a commercial record or reissue. All I'm trying to do, this is a public service. I'm paying from my own pocket money. I'm just doing for the own good of the community. I just need a cassette or a piece of tape with that particular thing that I need to include in this. And then came back the answer, sorry, we cannot do it. And that was prompted me a sort of very much interesting copyright issues. In the NAEB, National Association of Educational Broadcasters magazine of March 1965, I wrote a long article, about 30 pages, about some of the horror stories I have seen. I remember in one library, in one record library, I saw all of this stack of shellac records visually deteriorating, and I asked the man in charge, you should at least tape them, you know, too. And he said, oh, I would like to do it, I have the equipment, but somebody told me it was against the law. So it was, as I say, an absolute nightmare. So in the fall of 1968 at the UCLA meeting, I chaired a panel on copyright. And it was a very exciting panel. On one side was the corporate lawyer for Capitol Records. On the other side was Stan Kenton, representing the artist. I was there, a few other people. And there was almost a shouting match between Stan Kenton and the record company lawyer, because Stan Kenton represented that, he said, we want our music to be performed, to be alive, to be broadcast. If people like all of these record, all of these producers of educational broadcasting want them, we, the artists, want these records to be out. And the record company said, no, the contractual reasons and so on. Anyway, the transcripts appear in the Journal of the ARSC, December of 69. And then in the next meeting, the fall of 1969 in New York, William Krasilovsky, one of the most prominent copyright attorneys, came to talk, and he gave very much the same side. Fair use should be firmly established for non-profit educational use. And then he came out even more with the limited licensing. So for a small little companies that want to put out records long vanished, that the major companies, RCA, Capitol, EMI, Decca, don't have any interest, it's too expensive, let them go ahead, pay the royalties, and if by chance one of the records becomes a big seller, then the right will go back to the original company. So, anyway, I have to tell you, for example, about Vanderbilt University. It's a very interesting case. In the late 60s, they began recording off the air from the networks, in video and in audio, the newscasts, presidential speeches, congressmen, statements, and so on. So the CBS sued them, saying, this belongs to us. We will release only if people had to pay a price, and the thing that they always say is cost recovery. And I know some scholars, they try to approach CBS, NBC for some little segment and say, well, we can give it to you for $300. A scholar doesn't have that kind of money. So they sue Vanderbilt University. This enraged Congress so much. That means, you see, that we do have friends in Congress. That there was a bipartisan amendment introduced to the copyright law that is still now in the copyright statute that says specifically is not considered an infringement of copyright to record for preservation and scholarly distribution newscast material. And of course there are hundreds, in the meantime I have become very much interested in recording the access and the restriction that are put, and I have found, I have in my files over 100 cases of restriction, denials, problems. Very much like, it. Now in the book world this would be unheard of, but in sound recordings, let me mention just briefly three of four or five. In China, Mao Zedong, The Call of the Personality, there were hundreds of recordings, and now apparently this is very embarrassing for the authorities. All of those recordings have been completely vanished. Now, embarrassing as it might be to China, that is part of the Chinese history, and I feel that we should have access to that kind of material. Take the case of Nazi Germany. For 10 years, there were a number of outstanding compositions written with political tones and messages and overtones. That's part of the musical history of Germany, but the German government or the composers or the performers, nobody wants to recognize that, and all of those recordings have been virtually buried. Now, that's part, it's controversial, it's unpleasant, but it's part of German history, and I feel that we should have right to listen to some of those things to see how that particular period was represented in serious or popular music. Take the case of Giovanni Martinelli. One of the most stirring versions of La Giovinezza was performed by him. And of course, he or his heirs or the company don't want ever to recognize that he ever sang that. So how we reconcile the problems of the performer and the rights of the public? Take the case of Argentina, Juan Perón, Same thing, there were hundreds of recordings about Juan Perón, then they vanished. Take the case of, now, Cambria Records wanted to put out a recording of the Los Angeles Philharmonic in these early years, in the late 20s, how it sounded. And they had the transcription from the Hollywood Bowl conducted by Eugene Ormandy. They tried to get permission from Eugene Ormandy, and he said, no, under no circumstances, Eugene Ormandy wants to give permission, because the reason was given, he's embarrassed of ever conducting such an inferior orchestra. He's now too big. So he wants people to forget completely that he ever conducted a second-rate orchestra. So how you reconcile the rights of the conductor with the rights of the public of Los Angeles, who wants to know their musical heritage? And there are many other cases like that, as I said. Take the case of the Smithsonian. They put out a wonderful album on the civil rights movement songs. But I said to myself, wouldn't it be better if we could see the black struggle for liberation in the context of what they had to contend with? So I did a documentary, very controversial, where I put some of those songs with some of those really, you might say, quote-unquote, redneck, vicious, angry songs against black that were very popular in the jukebox of the South in the early 60s. Now, of course, you may say those songs of the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan, are racist, are vicious, but that gives you a very exciting vision, auditive, of what the black people had to fight against. So I did that documentary. Now you have to have access to that kind of material. And that's what I say is, I want to end now with a plea and an advocacy for this association to explore those issues. Bill Moran, for example, have been very concerned about fakery. You too, Michael, very concerned about that whole issue. And there are many other moral, ethical, legal issues. There are issues, for example, of dishonesty. One, for example, concerned the record company that put out the Beethoven's 9, 1942, Berlin version conducted by Furtwängler, that chopped, one piece is missing, and one part is speeded up, just to include that whole thing in one record. These are cases of fakery, dishonesty, legal, moral, ethical matters of access, rights, and I would like very much our association to go into that. Now also concerning copyright, we have to remember that the copyright statutes now provide for a constant ongoing revision. They don't want to go back to the nightmare of the past that we all know so well. Now, I think every 5 years there's a sort of a copyright review panel where they admit evidence and advice from all sorts of organizations, and I would like the arts to go into that, to have a sort of a dual track. One, going to the traditional, the wonderful work we're doing about discographies, accounts of recording sessions and so on, but also being very strong in the philosophical, ethical, moral issues. So that's what I have to say, and I don't know if I have this time for any questions or not.
Take to ask for questions, as I know we all will give him our litany of our own horror stories. Boy, I got something perfectly parallel to this, so you know, but we are a little bit behind time. Barbara?
Yes. What we propose to do, because the archive cannot handle all of us at once, is to split into two groups and ask half of you to go have some